Hello there. Thank you for tuning into CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly local current affairs program. It's Thursday, November 9th. It's about 5 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. I'm Rahmatullah Sheikh.
And I'm Ryan Patrick Jones. Today we're going to be reading you the headlines for the week. Metro Vancouver's affordability crisis has worsened despite foreign buyers tax. In August 2016, the BC government took steps to reduce some of the pressure in Metro Vancouver's overheated real estate market. They created a foreign buyers tax, which added a 15% property transfer tax for foreign nationals buying real estate in the Metro Vancouver area. New real estate data has found that the foreign buyers tax has in fact done the opposite of what it intended to do, according to some metrics. Although housing purchases by foreign buyers have increased since 2016, since the tax was implemented, the price of detached homes in the city has stabilized, and foreign buyers are purchasing more in the suburbs and selecting apartments and smaller properties.
105 Kiefer Street condo proposal was rejected by the City of Vancouver. The City of Vancouver's Development Permit Board rejected Beadle Living's building proposal with a 2-1 vote. The first time the board has outrightly rejected a building proposal since 2006. Although the proposal met structural regulations for the Chinatown area, the board ultimately decided that the design did not meet the cultural needs of the neighborhood. Anti-gentrification organizers in Chinatown are over the moon that the board is protecting low-income residents in the area. Beadle Living, however, still has options to push forward with their building plans, such as by submitting a revised proposal, negotiating with the city, or taking legal action against the decision. More on this story later in this broadcast.
November 8th was National Aboriginal Veterans Day in Canada. On Wednesday morning, veterans and other Vancouverites gathered at the Victory Square in downtown Vancouver in recognition of the thousands of Indigenous men and women who have served in the military. National Aboriginal Veterans Day ceremonies have been held across the country every November 8th since 1994. The day is meant to commemorate the contribution of Indigenous men and women who have often gone unmentioned at Remembrance Day ceremonies.
Rising sea level raises fear for the future of communities in Metro Vancouver. The United Nations predicts the world's oceans will be at least 1 meter higher by the end of the current century, and it could be 4 times that after 100 years, reports the Canadian Press. Now, global warming will have a huge effect on the Metro Vancouver area to see because of the sea level rises, as it is the most vulnerable urban area in Canada. There are currently 250,000 people living within a meter of sea level. Richmond currently sits at a meter above sea level. Some other areas most at risk are False Creek, Fairview, and Stanley Park. Plans to prevent and mitigate sea level rises are in the early stages in most communities around Metro Vancouver. Flood prevention, such as in the Fraser Delta, is projected to cost upwards of $10 billion.
More than 1,100 people have died of drug overdoses in British Columbia this year. On Thursday, the BC Coroner Service released a new tally on the number of deaths caused by illicit drug overdoses in the province. According to the report, 1,103 people have died from drug overdoses. This is almost 2 times the number of overdose deaths registered around the same time last year. The month of September alone witnessed 80 cases of suspected drug overdose deaths. The report also noted that in most cases, fentanyl was mixed with other drugs like cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamines.
A new study confirms that Vancouver has the most unaffordable housing in North America. Now, according to a study by Point2 Homes, Vancouver emerges as the city with the most unaffordable housing market, surpassing both Manhattan and San Francisco. The study surveyed the 50 most populous cities in North America. The results show that a home in Vancouver costs about 17 times the average annual household income of the residents. This is more than triple that the report considers to be severely unaffordable.
The City of Vancouver picks 2 additional locations for modular housing units. The City of Vancouver proposed 2 new locations for temporary modular housing sites meant to house homeless residents. A tent camp on the 1100 block of Franklin Street and a property at 501 Powell Street that is home to a weekly market and a community farm are the proposed locations. The city anticipates the structures in both locations will be 3 stories high and will provide 50 self-contained units. The proposal is part of the city's plan to install 600 temporary modular housing units by the end of this year. The council will have to make some policy changes and complete a public feedback process before construction can begin.
A new tent city in East Vancouver loses its heating and cooking sources. Nicknamed Sugar Mountain because of its proximity to the BC Sugar Refinery, a new tent city was erected in a city-owned lot in Strathcona on Tuesday evening. Firefighters and police officers have confiscated propane heaters, stoves, and other heating and cooking sources from Sugar Mountain. Those living in the tent city were told by police that the propane heaters are a fire hazard. Now, earlier this year, the Vancouver Fire and Rescue Service issued an order that banned propane devices, open flames, and barbecues used less than 3 meters from any tent or building. The confiscated heating sources are in violation of this order.
So those were this week's headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a short break and then hear some original reporting on last week's Me Too rally in downtown Vancouver.
Your Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
Youth for Chinese Seniors is holding a fundraiser to raise $12,000 for a seniors drop-in center in the heart of Chinatown. This organization connects youth and low-income seniors to combat issues of gentrification, racism, and other barriers. Find out more about Youth for Chinese Seniors and donate at youcaring.com/seedsforlongevity between now and November 10th.
Digitization is a program that provides resources and training for First Nations and Aboriginal organizations throughout British Columbia. Come out November 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. in room 2311 in the AMS Nest for a 3-hour workshop that will engage participants in a conversation about the unique context of working with Indigenous cultural heritage materials, as well as introduce the tools and equipment necessary to digitize audio cassettes for long-term preservation.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia on unceded Musqueam territory.
We're now going to turn our attention to a rally that happened this past weekend in downtown Vancouver. On Saturday, November 4th, roughly 100 people gathered to show their support and solidarity for the international Me Too movement.
The piece we're about to hear was originally reported for the UBC by News Collective members Aidan Tong and myself, Ryan Patrick Jones. The audio version was edited and produced by Olamide Olemanyan.
The Me Too movement vaulted from the feeds of social media users to the streets of Vancouver on Saturday. UBC students and alumni were among the 100 people who braved snow flurries and sub-zero temperatures to rally outside the Vancouver Art Gallery, calling for an end to sexual violence. Sophia Stevenson, a UBC student studying biology and chemistry, said,
"And I know many people, and I personally have experienced sexual assault, so I think it's an important cause to be rallying for."
The event featured the voices of sexual assault survivors. It was organized by the Vancouver chapter of March on Canada in solidarity with similar marches held in Toronto and Los Angeles. The event sought to build momentum for the broad Me Too movement. Jody Ortega, co-organizer and host of the rally, said it's important for people to take action beyond the realm of the internet. One of the themes of the event was that sexual assault affects people of different ages, races, and genders. Judy Lewinson of Black Voices Vancouver spoke at the event, saying,
"Many of us gathered here today are the survivors. Ours is a heartbreaking tapestry of sexual harassment and other violations far too horrific to politely recall. Some of us gathered here today are part of the incredible support system, adding strength and volume to our eclectic voices as we rightfully eliminate inexcusable transgressions and lay forth a non-negotiable demand for the culture and the hierarchy that has enabled this behavior to finally change."
Despite the power of the Me Too movement, organizers, participants, and attendees agree that the responsibility should not be solely placed on survivors. Indigenous writer Crystal Smith addressed men in the crowd, telling them that showing up to the rally is the first step. However, she went on to say that men need to bring this solidarity beyond the event. The original idea for Me Too came from Tarana Burke, an activist from Philadelphia. In 2006, Burke founded Just Be Inc., a nonprofit that helps women who have experienced sexual abuse, assault, and exploitation. The phrase began garnering global attention last month in the wake of allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. Some at the Vancouver rally criticized the disparity in response to the voices of women of color and those of white women. They pointed out that the efforts of women of color, like Burke, have been largely ignored. The issue entered the mainstream only after a flurry of accusations from white women. Commenting on the racial disparity of responses, Smith said,
"We have over 1,200 Indigenous women that have been murdered or missing. And it's only now, for the past 2 years, that we're seeing this, and it's been happening for decades. Decades it's been happening. And now people are finally seeing this. People of color have been saying these things for decades. And only now are we taking action. It's important to acknowledge the history. It's important to acknowledge that this is not new news. That this isn't a new hashtag. That this has been happening for decades."
Jada Lamb, a UBC student in sociology, agreed.
"It's not a coincidence that like 10 years ago, a woman of color started this movement and no one paid attention to it. So I do think it has a big part of it is the fact that it's a white actress that's like popular that kind of started it. And you know, once people start speaking out, it's a lot easier too, but I do think that a big part of it is, you know, who started it and like the people that responded to it and the sort of media attention that was brought."
In a phone interview, UBC professor Jennifer Berdahl identifies this issue as one of systemic and structural racism. Berdahl has been studying sexual harassment for over 20 years.
"You know, white power and privilege is always going to give white voices and experiences more weight in our culture than those of racialized people. You know, I think it's a good thing that powerful women are coming forward now and using, I guess, their platforms to bring awareness to this cause. Mm-hmm. Before, they used to sort of remain silent about it and in some ways remain complicit in it by doing so. But, you know, sexual harassment, Anita Hill pointed this out really well in a New Yorker article last week. Sexual harassment isn't about sex, it's about power, and it requires power to combat it. And so until the accusers are extremely powerful and can't be ignored, people aren't going to take them seriously. And so, you know, a sad fact in our culture is that white women have a lot more power and are considered a lot more believable than women of color."
UBC has a checkered history when it comes to dealing with sexual assault. Until this year, sexual misconduct complaints were dealt with under a generic policy for, quote-unquote, non-academic discrimination, the same one used for vandalism and theft. A 2015 CBC Fifth Estate investigation revealed major flaws in the process of reporting and investigating sexual assault at UBC. The university is currently facing two human rights complaints by former students alleging the university mishandled their cases. Following the provincial government's April 2016 mandate that all post-secondary institutions have a standalone policy for dealing with sexual misconduct, the UBC Board of Governors approved Policy 131. Policy 131 is UBC's new, quote-unquote, sexual assault and other misconduct policy for handling sexual assault allegations. The policy includes a wide range of personal support, including counseling services. The new strategy mandated that a sexual violence prevention and response office exist on both UBC campuses. According to UBC, the Vancouver office has been fully operational since mid-October, but the timeline remains as vague as, quote-unquote, later this year for the Okanagan. These offices function as centralized places for reporting and investigating allegations of sexual assault. Policy 131's goal is for the student environment to be free from sexual misconduct and for the university to express support for victims of sexual assault. It remains to be seen whether this new policy will be enough to achieve this. This is Aiden Tong reporting for Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
And that was Aiden Tong reporting on the Me Too rally in Vancouver this last Saturday. The audio was produced by Olamide Olanyan, whose name I mispronounced earlier, and I apologize for that.
This is Democracy Watch. We'll be back with some more news after a short break.
Youth for Chinese Seniors is holding a fundraiser to raise $12,000 for a seniors drop-in center in the heart of Chinatown. This organization connects youth and low-income seniors to combat issues of gentrification, racism, and other barriers. Find out more about Youth for Chinese Seniors and donate at youcaring.com/seedsforlongevity between now and November 10th.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
Tired of a world of no when you have so much to give?
CITR and Discord got you with an outfit for all that.
Volunteer Wednesdays are back in the CITR lounge.
It's an open house for members like you who are looking to meet cool people and get into the station.
Join up, meet some folks, help some causes, or just hang the freak out.
At the CITR Discord Lounge from 1 to 3 every Wednesday for food and good times.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
UBC Theater and Film presents a world premiere shining with love and possibility. Wives and Daughters by Jacqueline Firkins, based on Elizabeth Gaskell's Victorian serial novel, is a charming romp of love convoluted by hidden desires and expectations.
I like to be liked, but when people carry their affection too far, they become troublesome.
Cynthia's a sweet girl and charming, but she was always in some spot of trouble. She wasn't mischievous exactly, but mischief seemed to follow her.
Join us from November 9th to 25th at the Frederick Wood Theater.
After a certain age, a daughter becomes inconvenient.
So we must stop being inconvenient daughters and become inconvenient wives?
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia on unceded Musqueam territory. After rejecting or deferring a proposed development at 105 Kiefer Street five times in the last 3 years, the City of Vancouver outright rejected the mixed-use condo development on Tuesday, November 7th. This is the first time since 2006 that the Development Permit Board has rejected an application. The mayor refused to comment to connect the council's recent apology to Vancouver's Chinese community with the rejection of the housing application, but advocates argue they are related. Both BD Living and the housing industry have criticized the development's rejection.
BD Living issued a statement on Tuesday saying, and I quote, We are extremely disappointed that the institutions mandated to provide regulatory and policy framework, that is the City of Vancouver planning staff and the council, endorsed and appointed Urban Design Panel and Development Permit Board Advisory Panel, have undermined and their unanimous support for 105 Kiefer ignored by select members of the Development Permit Board. Like many people, we are uncertain that this unprecedented decision will mean for these civic institutions.
We'll now hear an exclusive interview with Jannie Lung, an organizer with Chinatown Action Group. Lung is celebrating the development rejection as a long-fought victory for the Chinatown community.
I'm Alamdi Alanion from Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm here with Jannie, an organizer from Chinatown Action Group. Thanks for being here. Thanks for talking to me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so could you tell the listeners who you are and what you do?
Sure. So my name's Jannie Lung. I'm also known as Lung Wing Si, my Chinese name. I'm a community organizer with the Chinatown Action Group, and we're an intergenerational group of Chinese people who are working to build people power and social justice across working class communities.
Could you give us a little primer or recap on what the 105 Kiefer Street battle is about?
Sure, yeah. So 105 Kiefer is a site that we consider that's in the heart of Chinatown. So it's a very significant site. If you're familiar with the neighborhood, it's on Kiefer Street at Columbia. And this is right beside the Kiefer Triangle. So that's where the Memorial Plaza is. So there's a memorial to the Chinese railroad workers and the Chinese veterans. It's also beside the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Garden. So it's a very, both culturally and historically, a significant site. So this piece of land was purchased by the developer BD Living in 2013. And since then, they've applied multiple times to try to build condos on this site. So it's been a three-year battle for the community, and throughout this whole time there has been strong and sustained community opposition to that site, both because it's very culturally significant, but also because of the overall picture of gentrification in Chinatown, what's been happening. So this was BD Living's fifth application to build condos on that site. It went to the Development Permit Board on Monday. And surprisingly, to everyone's surprise, it was rejected by the Development Permit Board, and that's a huge win for the community. This is pretty rare that things get rejected, and I think it says a lot about the powerful community organizing that we did, and also just the strength of our ability to make ourselves heard, and it was great that the city respected that and honored that and made the right choice.
What are the exact demands that the community wanted from the housing that gets built there or doesn't get built there?
Our main demand is that, Chinatown is a neighborhood that had a lot of development pressures, very intensive development pressures in the past few years. And so we've seen rents increasing in the neighborhood. We've seen a lot of the businesses that serve the Chinese community and the low-income community either closing down because of the high taxes that have been increasing or moving away. And we're seeing more and more that low-income people, both Chinese and a lot of, there's a lot of non-Chinese people who live in the neighborhood. They're getting pushed out of the neighborhood. And so we think it's completely inappropriate to build more market housing in this neighborhood where there's a housing crisis. So we've been calling for the whole time that this site needs to be dedicated to 100% affordable social housing. And when we say that, we mean the $375 a month that's allocated to people on income assistance. And we're also calling for the building to have a truly public, accessible community space where community members can gather and a place for people to go. Those were our main demands. And so with the decision on Monday that rejected the building of these condos, for us, we recognize that it's a win, but it's a small win within a bigger battle of continuing to push all three levels of government to build affordable social housing for the community.
How would the social housing work? Would you require the provincial or, I guess, municipal government to buy that space and then, like, build social housing there? How does that work?
Yeah, so that's been our preferred demand, I suppose. So, Yeah, so one of the arguments we keep hearing is that this land is privately owned. They can do what they want with it. But, you know, we argue that, you know, we know that's not true, right? Like, just because you own a land privately doesn't mean you can do whatever you want if it harms the community. And we believe that having market housing there will harm the community. So we are calling for all three levels of government to buy back the land. And, you know, historically, federal governments, provincial governments have given more money to so building social housing. And it was the government cutbacks and the austerity measures, particularly the 90s, that changed all that and changed the discourse around that too. So we are calling on these governments to fulfill their responsibilities. And we're hoping with the new NDP government and also the federal Liberal government coming out with a national housing strategy. So we're hoping that, well, we're going to keep pressuring them to build social housing because, as we know, the homelessness crisis is increasing. We've had over 2,000 people who were counted as homeless in the last count, and this can't be normalized, right? Like, we can't be building market housing when there's people sleeping on the street.
Thank you. I know that I've been looking at tweets and looking at like blogs from people that were like at the, I guess, the one from last week, the, I'm not sure which one that was, but the initial meeting of the permit board. And I remember reading about how the permit board usually doesn't have to decide on things that don't have to do with like heights of the building or like the ordinary criteria. But this rejection looks like they, I guess, factored in cultural significance and also like the effect on the community, because I think before it used to go to like, or it used to be referred to like the city council, right? So could you just like explain just like what, maybe I'm just like really confused, but just explain what that means or, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's such a confusing process and we've had to learn too throughout this campaign. So I'll try to explain it in a nutshell, but so what happened last May was it did, so this proposal went to council, and that's because BD Living had been asking for a rezoning. So they bought this land expecting to be able to build higher than what is allowed in that area. So right now in that area, the maximum you're allowed to build is 9 stories. BD Living wanted to build an extra 3 stories, so they wanted to build a 12-story building. And to do that, you have to apply for a rezoning, and rezoning applications go to city council. So just a few months ago, we also went to City Hall in droves, like hundreds of us opposing this rezoning application. So when City Council rejected that in June, BD right away came back with, you know, the maximum they could build. That's a 9-story building. And because that's at the existing zoning height that's allowed, it no longer needs to go to City Council, and it goes to the Development Permit Board. And my understanding of how the Development Permit Board assesses these, it's not so much, like, generally, it's not so much about social impact, but more about the design of the building. Like, does the exterior fit within the existing zoning guidelines and the neighborhood? And so part of the decision was that this building, I don't know if you've seen kind of the sketches of these buildings, but it's not appropriate for such an important cultural site, right? Like, it looks pretty close to, like, a typical Vancouver condo building. And the fact that it's in Chinatown beside these other very historic buildings, that factored in a lot to their decision of rejecting the building. And I do think the process we went through of all these speakers rejecting this building or opposing this building being put in the community, we cited a lot of social impacts, economic impacts. I don't know how much that weighed into that decision, but I think it definitely highlighted kind of the gaps in the process that they have, right? Because I think considering the cultural and social impacts is one, and also for us, the most frustrating part was the lack of inclusivity and the lack of interpretation that was provided at these hearings in a neighborhood that we know has a large proportion of people who speak Chinese and cannot speak English. So that for us was also a huge, I mean, it was throughout these 3 years that we've been opposing this condo development, we've also had to deal with like city processes, right? City consultation processes where there's inadequate interpretation services. There's also, you know, when speakers sign up to speak at these city meetings and processes, they're only, if you need interpretation, that in the time that your speech is interpreted into English counts within the 5 minutes that you're allowed to speak. So essentially the Chinese speakers that came and needed interpretation, they got half the time to speak as everyone else. And the proceedings, like all these discussions that the board made, were not interpreted back into Chinese to them. So they didn't really understand what was going on, right? And they got to watch people make decisions about their neighborhood and not be able to be part of that or understand what's going on. And for us, I think we have been trying to push for it for a long time, and we haven't really gotten any movement from the city. And that for us is appalling, right? Like in this day and age, that something as easy as interpretation is not provided by the city. And it was up to our amazing volunteers in the community that did whisper interpretation for a lot of the Chinese people that came and wanted to be part of the process. And also as a side note, when we were doing whisper translation, the board said we were being very disruptive. So I think there's just this culture of this culture that's still lacking in terms of inclusivity, and we would say, you know, that's systemic discrimination, and that needs to change, right? And that was one of the calls we made to the board, and they said they would be reviewing their processes, so we'll be watching them very closely for that.
Cool, thank you. So what's like the major, what do you think the major reason why, I don't know if like the other, the economic and like community effect of BD would have affected the board's decision, but what do you think is like the major reason why they like rejected the proposal?
Yeah, you know, I think they will say, because they're following their guidelines, they will say it's not an appropriate fit for the neighborhood. But I also think, you know, this whole process, like not just what happened at the development permit board, but our whole, you know, 3-year battle where this is BD's fifth attempt to build on the site, I think our community has been so successful in opposing it because there has been a lot of unity in the community, and not just unity among, you know, people that live in Chinatown, but, you know, it was truly an intergenerational effort. Like, I like to tell people that, you know, we have high school students involved, we've had children come attend our rallies, and our oldest member is 100 years old, or 101 years old, actually, and she's the daughter of a head tech survivor. So I think it's,
wow.
You know, yeah, it's amazing intergenerational effort, and brought a lot of people who, you know, care very deeply about Chinatown, and we showed up. Like, every meeting that they had, we showed up, and, you know, I have so much respect for those Chinese-speaking seniors who, even though they don't know, they didn't know what was happening, right, they don't understand English, and they didn't understand the processes, they still continue to show up because they cared so deeply about this, and yeah, I think that's really the power of community, and the fact that we're able to turn up like over like 1 in 200 speakers to these city meetings is amazing. Like, this is kind of unprecedented, and I think it really speaks to the fact that there's power in the community. And I think I see what's happening in Chinatown as kind of, it's the same thing as happening across Vancouver, right? There's a housing crisis. In Chinatown, it's kind of the epicenter where it's very intense. But, you know, I think the issues around housing and precarity, and also the need for low-income people to have their voices heard, I think that's something that resonates with many people in Vancouver. And I think just the fact that these low-income people were able to show up at every meeting and still speak despite the racism and the discrimination of the processes and have their voices heard, I think that's really powerful and something that, like, has taught us a lot about what it means to organize and fight for something you believe in.
Thank you. My final question is just, like, what do you think BD wants? Like, they've been faced so much opposition over the past few years. They've been rejected several times. How do you think, what do they want, and do you see what they want changing in the near future?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think we ask ourselves that too. But, you know, I think with this latest proposal that they've put forward and tried to pass, it made it really clear what BD's true objectives are. And that was to make as much profit as possible, right? Like, in a previous version of their application, they had offered some units of social housing that had to be purchased by BC Housing, but in this latest iteration, there was 111 units of market housing and 0 units of social housing. And BD said they had consulted extensively with community to come to this proposal. And so we know that's not true, right? Because we've been saying the whole time that what we need is affordable social housing, not market housing. So if they had truly listened to the community and consulted, they would try to, you know, they would try to work with the community, but they clearly haven't. So our take is that they just want to make as much profit as possible. So we'll see going forward what their next step is. They do have the option to appeal, but, you know, we've fought them this far. We will meet them there when they appeal, and we will be continuing our work with the 3 levels of government to try to get them to buy the site and build social housing.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an exclusive interview with Chinatown Action Group organizer Janie Leung, conducted by Olamide Olanion. We'll be back with some more news after this break. Stay tuned.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Sometimes it feels like the only thing
you can count on in life is the fact that Mint Records will always have a Christmas party and always have it ridiculously early. This year, join Woolworm, Needles and Pins, Jay Arner, Supermoon, Kellerisa, and Dumb at the Astoria on December 2nd for music, presents, and Christmas fun.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend, and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Save the date for Pivots and Spins, Access Gallery's annual auction fundraiser on November 18th at 7 p.m. Promising to be Access's most exciting auction yet, Pivots and Spins features spectacular work generously donated by over 50 local and international artists, including Eli Bornowski, Daria Ake, Cindy Machizuki, Kathleen Ritter, and Sandra Semchuk. Complete with handcrafted cocktails, organic BC wines from Summerhill Pyramid Winery, Pilsner from Steam Whistle Brewery, works expertly framed by Fine Art Framing, and music organized by CITR 101.9 FM. Check out www.accessauction.tumblr.com for more details about contributing artists, the silent auction, and live auction works.
And we're back with Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Ryan Jones.
And I'm Madeline Zeef.
This week on Democracy Watch, we covered last weekend's Me Too rally in Vancouver and the rejection of the proposed housing development at 105 Kiefer Street. You just heard an exclusive interview with Chinatown Action Group organizer Janie Leung, conducted by Olamide Olanion.
We're going to continue on this topic. We have in the studio a member of CITR's student executive, Rachel Lau. Rachel has written an article in November's edition of Discorder magazine. Their piece is titled Youth for Chinese Seniors and Intergenerational Collaboration in Chinatown. Welcome to Democracy Watch, Rachel.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So can you just start off by describing your article to our listeners?
Yeah, for sure. So in the article, I talked about one particular Chinatown organization, and that's called Youth for Chinese Seniors. What I did was outline a little bit of the history of Youth for Chinese Seniors, but what I really wanted to touch on was this idea and also the focus of intergenerational connection in Chinatown. So I think Janie mentioned earlier in the interview that Olamide did where we're seeing a lot of the community come together, especially the youth and seniors. And Youth for Chinese Seniors is a really shining example of what's happening in the neighborhood. And the main reason for that is because often the youth have language skills, like being able to speak English and read English fluently. And that skill is so important to helping Chinese seniors because Chinese seniors are not afforded the opportunity to learn English. And when they come here, basically they have to work for their life and there just isn't time or like there aren't resources for them to do that. So now that, you know, they're in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s, that's just not something that's possible for them anymore. And so what the youth do is we're able to help provide translation or interpretation services for them. And so that's what we talked about in the article. In addition to that, I touched on the fundraiser that's happening for Youth for Chinese Seniors at the moment. And basically the organizer, Yolanda, talked about how there is such a huge need for a space that's exclusively for Youth for Chinese Seniors. Because what we're noticing in Chinatown is that with gentrification, a lot of the spaces for low-income community members, especially low-income Chinese seniors, are disappearing. And so, you know, in that climate, Youth for Chinese Seniors is really trying to build something that is, you know, for us, by us. So that's what we talked about. That's what I wrote about in the article.
Cool. Okay. So what did you think about Janie Leung's insights, especially how they relate to your article? Could you talk more a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think Janie touched on sort of the key points that we always talk about in the community and most folks know about, especially if they're involved with the resistance organization or resistance organizing, in Chinatown, especially against gentrification, is this idea that inclusivity and access is really not there at the moment, especially between the city and low-income Chinese seniors. And a big part of that is the language. So Janie mentioned how during the public hearings in the city, interpretation services were not provided. So the Chinese seniors who were there who wanted to know what was happening and what other people were saying could only understand with the help of volunteers who donate their time. But the city did not provide that. And also the Chinese seniors who chose to speak, their time to speak was effectively cut in half because they were given the same amount of time as everyone else. So it's like half interpretation, half the actual speaking part. And how that relates is that Youth for Chinese Seniors is really addressing that kind of gap in access because we are helping Chinese seniors access the services that they need and to be able to live and survive in this climate, especially with gentrification, you know, happening so rapidly in Chinatown by providing these language services. And also, in addition to that, there is a sense of, you know, what Janie talks about in the interview, like there is this sense of like isolation for the Chinese seniors when it comes to just having a say in what is happening to their neighborhood and also how they move through their neighborhood, right? Because like I said before, we're losing spaces in Chinatown. So increasingly, like, there are fewer and fewer stores that low-income Chinese seniors or the Chinese community feel like they can go into. Like, for example, there are like fancy coffee shops and like these ice cream places that are popping up in Chinatown. Like, those, like, elders in Chinatown, they don't see that store and they don't say like, oh yeah, I totally want to walk in there because I can totally afford this, or like, I see people like me in there. No, like, it's just completely foreign to them. And for them to have lived so long in this neighborhood and have grown to know it, it's really jarring to have these sudden businesses and retailers pop up and all their long-term businesses moving away. So Youth for Chinese Seniors is really trying to build that social aspect as well with just creating events for Chinese seniors to gather and to be able to express their concerns and to really feel like they're heard. But I think the most beautiful part about that work, and Janie touched on this already, like, I love that she said unity in the community, because it's true, but also because it rhymes, is that youth and Chinese seniors are really coming together to better our neighborhood. And it's not like, oh, youth are saviors or whatever because, oh, young people are all that. It's not. We're learning so much from the Chinese elders as well because their voice is so important. And Chinese seniors want to hear from youth as well. And so there is that sort of reciprocal relationship happening. And I think that's how Youth for Chinese Seniors work. And also what I've said in my article relates to what Janie said in her interview. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you talk a lot about gentrification, and I think it's difficult for us to walk that line between like revitalizing the community and gentrifying it. As an organizer, could you just like talk about that and how we can walk that line better?
Yeah, totally. I think the first step is definitely to educate yourself, because I have faith in people, so I'm gonna say this, but I think a lot of people actually don't know that the businesses that they're supporting and the venues that they're going to is contributing to gentrification in the neighborhood. I think that revitalization is often used as like this nice shiny word to replace. It's like a euphemism for gentrification, but it doesn't have to be. But often that is the case. For example, this is more of a tangent, but there is the Chinatown Revitalization Action Plan that's being proposed by the city. And that's another project that our community will be working on. But that changes the zoning policies in Chinatown in order for like higher density and higher height buildings to be built more easily. And they call it revitalization plan, but really it's to accommodate the new like luxury condos that people want to build, such as the one that Beattie wants to build. And I say that because people see the neighborhood changing, and for some folks who are unaware and are not informed, for them it seems like a good thing, right? Because like, oh, Chinatown, it's like so dingy and dirty, and now it's all glamorous, and we got coffee, we got record stores, like we got this barbershop that has like $35 cuts, right? And some people see that as a good thing, and I can understand that, but it really comes down to being informed. It's like, at what cost are these businesses popping up? At what cost? Who's being affected? And who is being left out when these things come into the neighborhood? And so when we're thinking about Youth for Chinese Seniors, I think that it is a shining example of how to revitalize the neighborhood and how to bring in, you know, a different population of people to the neighborhood without gentrifying it. So what that looks like is that youth are coming in and spending time there and spending energy in the neighborhood and connecting with seniors without supporting gentrifying retail, without contributing to gentrification in the neighborhood. And I think that there is a common misconception that Chinatown is some sort of like dying neighborhood. And I think that's just ridiculous when people say that, because like, no, we're living and thriving there. And the Chinese seniors are still going about their daily activities. Families go there. There are kids who go there. Like, that there's still that happening. It's just that people don't see that necessarily as activity. They see like, oh, well, you know, it's just dirty, like you have these old businesses here and like everything's falling apart, and they see this new, you know, wave of activity from gentrifiers, unfortunately, as revitalization or like bringing good into the neighborhood. But it doesn't need to look like that. And I think that one big thing that we need to start thinking about as a community is creating more opportunities for youth and people of different generations to be able to exist in the neighborhood. And that looks a lot like organizing and, you know, creating infrastructure that is built by the community. And Youth for Chinese Seniors is doing exactly that. By creating this drop-in center, not only does it create opportunities, but it also creates an actual physical space where we can be there and revitalize the neighborhood in a different way that doesn't displace and isolate low-income Chinese seniors.
So was this intergenerational collaboration, is this a new thing, or did it used to be organic and now we're kind of structuring it more? How did this come about?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's something that I want to look more into as well. I'm actually quite new to doing more activism-oriented work in Chinatown. I actually grew up in Chinatown. My mom had a business there on Kiefer Street. And so I feel really connected to the neighborhood. But obviously, when I was a kid, I didn't really know about any of the organizing there. I think that the gentrification was definitely not happening as rapidly when I was a kid. But I would definitely say that the resurgence of youth in the neighborhood is a newer thing But that being said, I am actually currently working on a project looking at a radio show that used to be broadcasted in Chinatown, and it's called Pender Guy Radio. And guy is like a wordplay, because guy is a Cantonese word for street. And so it's like Pender Guy, Pender Street. And this was made by Chinese Canadian youth to address some of the discrimination that was happening in Chinatown. So there is that youth organization that exists, like youth organizing that existed in the past. But I think definitely now this resurgence of youth who are helping to organize, I think it is a new thing and it's a really exciting thing.
Cool. You mentioned Kiefer Street, and I just want to touch on that while we have time. So the recent victory of 105 Kiefer Street seemed to be like a big surprise. Why do you think the organizers were successful against all the odds?
Yeah, honestly, it's their resilience, it's their perseverance, and just like sheer passion, because these people are literally showing up for, you know, more than 3 hours at these public hearings, and they're organizing. These are like people who are doing day jobs. Like, they're organizing it on the side. And to think about how, for example, the developer, like, this is their job. Like, this is their full-time job to develop things. And it's just amazing to see the amount of resilience that our community has and how much we've come together to fight against, well, gentrification in the neighborhood. And we've seen a similar kind of unity when people were fighting against the railways that were trying to be built through Chinatown. I forget the year of when that happened, but a lot of those people who were involved in that organizing, or the children of the people who were really involved in that organizing, are really involved with what we're doing now at 105 Kiefer Street. So it's truly just people seeing what is happening to the neighborhood and really coming together to make a difference and to resist against, well, greedy development in our neighborhood.
Yeah. So just last things, do you have anything to add, any stories that were left out? I know in your article you talked with Aubrey, who is a Chinese senior. Did she have anything interesting, any good stories to tell?
Yeah, and so the Chinese senior who commented, they wanted to remain anonymous, so like Audrey's not actually their name, but what was I gonna say? Oh yeah, so what I want to add, I think people need to learn more about Chinatown and how it came to be, and I think that people just need to spend more time in Chinatown and support the businesses that are there, who have always been there. And I think something that I want to touch on that a lot of people talk about is like, oh, well, doesn't the Chinese community have Richmond? Like, why do we still need Chinatown? But those are two very different places filled with two very different kinds of communities that have come to Vancouver and built something of their own. And Chinatown is something of their own. I think people need to learn the history of Chinatown, which is that basically the city of Vancouver and the government didn't want Chinese people to go anywhere else, and we weren't allowed to buy land anywhere else, we weren't allowed to work anywhere else, and the piece of land that Chinatown is on now was considered undesirable at the time, and we were all kind of like pushed there, and it was because of our resilience and our will to survive that we built what we have here now that we call Chinatown. And I think once people understand what that means and the significance of that history, there is a reconsideration of what's happening in the neighborhood.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel. That was really, really informational.
Thanks.
Yes. Thank you so much. So you've been listening to Democracy Watch, and that's a wrap for today. It's 5:55 on Thursday, November 9th, and we hope you enjoyed our show. Please tune in again next Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. Next week's show will be a special broadcast focused on the CBC's digital media strategy.
The internet has disrupted and altered our lives in so many ways, and the same is true for the practice of journalism. Our special segment will examine how our public broadcaster is adjusting to these disruptions caused by digital technologies and the internet. It features an exclusive interview with CBC's outgoing president and CEO, Hubert Lacroix, and Taylor Owen, who is the assistant professor at the Liu Institute for Global Issues and the Graduate School of Journalism.
You are listening to Democracy Watch. The next show up on CITR is Dead Air. Stay tuned.